From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine on New York State government and politics. Your host is Dave Gallantly, with commentary by political scientist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University of New York at New Paltz.
Coming up this week, New York's legislators return to Albany to discuss the budget and elect legislative leaders. We'll tell you what's going on. We'll also have a report on the state of the judiciary, and Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen will be along for a chat. Those stories, Alan Shartok, and much, much more on this week's Legislative Gazette. Discussions of furloughs and layoffs continued in Albany this week, and those discussions, by all accounts, were not going well. The Civil Service Employees Association, the state's largest public employees union, broke off talks with the Cuomo administration over furloughs. CSEA President Joe McDermott says talks broke down when the Cuomo administration refused to pay back the money CSEA workers would lose in furloughs. CSEA spokesman Mike Moran says there are alternatives to furloughs, but nobody's listening.
But we offered them substantial savings that we thought our members would accept and sought protections for our members in return. They have refused to even consider that. Our message now to the legislature is that they should put pressure on the governor to come back and enter into meaningful talks, because if they impose the furloughs on state employees, it strikes at the very heart of the collective bargaining process and will make labor relations in the state very difficult for years to come.
Meanwhile, the second largest state employee union says it will loan the state $90 million in deferred salaries to avert the proposed furloughs. The cornerstone of the Public Employees Federation plan is an extra 10-day lag in the state payroll. Basically, once the lag was fully phased in, employees would be paid 4 weeks after they work. But unlike Governor Cuomo's furlough plan, they would be paid for all their work. State Office of General Services Commissioner John Hudak says he understands the concerns of the unions, but furloughs are the only way to avoid more layoffs.
The furlough program, as the governor has indicated, is a very, very important keystone in being able to minimize what the actual number of layoffs are that are going to be required in order to close the budget gap that exists now, which is $1 billion, and which even the most conservative individuals are estimating to have the potential to be $3 billion next year. So I think that there's a need to really assess on the part of organized labor who represent public employees the benefits of the furlough versus the alternative, which really is would have to be more layoffs. And I think that's been very clearly stated, and it's a fact. It's not a matter of intimidation at all. It's just a matter of reality.
OGS Commissioner John Hudak. The state legislature was back in Albany this week to discuss the budget deficit and to elect majority and minority leaders. By the middle of the week, little progress was reported on the budget front, but the leaders had been elected. In the assembly, Mel Miller and Clarence Rappelier held on to their respective majority and minority leadership posts. Ralph Marino also held on to his Senate majority leadership seat. The only interesting race was for the Senate minority. Brian Shields reports.
In the end, the vote wasn't even close. Manfred Orenstein is still the state Senate's minority leader. Orenstein was challenged by another New Yorker, Martin Connor. Connor said he was short by a vote or two, and he did not want to put his supporters through the pressure of a roll call vote, so he withdrew his nomination.
I spoke to the members of the conference about why I still want to be minority leader, why I want to be minority leader now. Told them what I've been saying all along, that there's a need for change. There's a need for change. There's a need for new leadership. That's what I told them.
Basically, they rejected the argument of you would be a full-time leader where Fred Orenstein is not. They rejected that argument.
I still want to be minority leader. That's all I can say.
Wasn't that your main pitch?
I still want to be minority leader. That's all I can say.
When do you expect there to be another vote on it?
I still want to be minority leader.
You expect another vote on it before the end of this year?
I still want to be minority leader.
How many votes were each?
I still want to be minority leader.
Deputy Minority Leader Manny Gold said it was easy to see why Orenstein won again.
Because most of the people in that conference, the overwhelming majority of people in that conference, have faith in him. They are smart enough to know that in a year when the governor did not do that great, when a lot of things were going on, when we had wonderful candidates running on lines that were drawn by Republicans to elect Republicans, even though we had great candidates, we didn't win. And these people know all of that. This is a sophisticated group. And they think that Fred Ornstein has been a good leader and will be a good leader, and we are a loyal bunch of people. I hold nothing against Marty for running. It's America, and he had a right to run. But I don't believe from the beginning there was a chance he was going to win, and I was right.
Following his victory, Ornstein said he was grateful to his colleagues for their support and added he was optimistic about the next 2 years. As for his relationship with Senator Connor, he said there would be no bad blood between him and the challenger.
None whatsoever.
Is he going to keep his leadership post?
We are sitting, the leadership positions that I've deliberately made no announcements about that is because I intend to sit down with my colleagues and try to restructure the leadership in a positive way in order to make certain that, that the leadership properly reflects this conference. So there will be changes in the leadership. I have no plans to do anything negative to anybody.
Connor did have some support in the voice vote. It came from Syracuse's Nancy Lorraine Hoffman. She explained her reasons for opposing Ornstein.
Well, there was no other choice at that point. I have a lot of differences of opinion with the current leadership of the Democratic Senate. There are far too many of them to really begin listing. You know, I happen to be kind of an island in this state, but I think that if we're going to be a viable Democratic Party in this House, we have to reach out to more upstate Democrats. And I think that requires a real change in our bearings. But I'm only one person, and I was clearly outvoted on that front.
Ornstein still has to face charges of hiring no-show workers in 1986 in an effort to take control of the state Senate from the Republicans. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Brian Shields.
As you've just heard, Manfred Ornstein dodged a political bullet this week, and that's the subject I discussed with our political analyst, Dr. Alan Chartok.
Aha! But who was he challenged by? He was challenged by Martin Connor. Now, Martin Connor is a backbencher in the Democratic Conference, and what ended up happening was he attempted to leap over the shoulders of the two heirs apparent for the minority Democratic leadership. They were Emanuel Gold of Queens and Donald Halpern of Brooklyn. Both guys have been waiting around for years and years for Fred Ornstein to move over and let them become the leader, and they'll have to fight it out. But one thing I'm sure they were in common on, Marty Connor wasn't going to jump over their backs in order to take on Ornstein. I knew that logic right from the beginning and said so, that in fact Ornstein would survive. Then what happened is that Marty Connor was able to get a commitment from members of the Black and Puerto Rican caucus within the Democratic ranks, and then a division began to exist when Alga Mendez, a Hispanic member, said she was not going to go along with some of the other members, and there ensued this sort of internecine fight. It was clear they didn't have the votes, but when you say he dodged the bullet, it was a potent bullet, and they did come within a couple of votes of being able to knock Fred off. But those couple of votes are like being a little bit pregnant. Either you are or you aren't. Only Nancy Lorraine Hoffman ended up voting for Marty Connor. My sense of it is that she voted against because she has a long history of antipathy with Fred Ornstein, one of the reasons was that when she was elected, the Ornstein troops totally disregarded her a number of years ago, said she didn't have a chance, and she has apparently never forgotten the fact that they didn't support her, they didn't give her the money, and she has always been a thorn in their side, and this was just one more sort of flare of temper. Connor said he'd be back, that he wanted to be the minority leader or the majority leader. I wouldn't count on it.
Legislative Gazette political analyst Dr. Alan Chartok. As the budget discussions continue in Albany, some cutbacks in state departments are already being felt. Bruce Robertson reports on how one department is already cutting back.
The Department of Parks and Recreations is not immune to the governor's list of budget cuts. Because it is so late in the year, many of the department's winter programs will suffer. According to spokeswoman Arlene Post, $400,000 was cut from the department's budget.
Well, we've worked very hard to minimize the end user effect and how the people who are accustomed to using and enjoying our state parks, historic sites, will see limits on their activities. Unfortunately, with the deficit reduction plan coming as late in the year as it is, We've already expended much of our budget as the State Parks Agency over the summer months providing swimming and other activities. So there are a limited number of options as to where we can place those cuts.
The department then went to its 11 regional offices and left it up to those offices which programs should be cut. Post says a variety of offerings will be affected. In the end, it all depends on where you live.
In some places, there will be less plowing, both in terms of roads into the park or perhaps a parking area where you might have gotten closer to a cross-country ski area. Some places where there used to be groomed cross-country ski trails, you might have to forge your own path at this point. And most immediately, there have been many festivals and similar events that would take place at our parks and historic sites that have had to be canceled, or in some cases, were able to maintain them through the generosity of private sponsors.
The Saratoga region was asked to cough up the most money. The cuts there will affect 8 parks in 9 counties. The region has canceled all of its winter festivals and programs and laid off 16 employees earlier than expected. The hours of several other employees will be reduced as well. Plowing and ski trail grooming will be reduced. The New York City region will not have to make any cuts since the cuts vary from park to park and region to region. Post says you should call ahead to see if your plans will be affected. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson.
The state is looking into the work of the Martin Luther King Jr. Institute for Nonviolence. Monday's editions of the New York Post reported that the state is not looking at the work being done, but how it's being done. State Inspector General Joseph Spinelli is investigating charges of sexual harassment, anti-Semitism, bid rigging, nepotism, and excessive salaries. The charges have come from employees who've been upset with the way work was conducted. Our Mike Fondacaro spoke with the writer of the Post story, Fred Dicker, to learn about the investigation.
For how long do these employees say that these practices were going on?
Well, it can't be for too long because the institute itself is only about a year and a half old. According to the employees, or the information that I've obtained on what the employees are alleging, it's been about a year. Some of the serious charges of sexual harassment, for instance, took place in the spring of this year. Some of the claims of improper use of monies of the agency date from last year into this year. And so they all would be within the last year, year and a half. It's not, it can't go back too far because it's a relatively new state agency.
And the state has known nothing about this up until the investigation started?
Well, there have been rumors around for some time that there may have been some problems over at this institute, but not until now with the formal investigation, the issuance of subpoenas, and people speaking on the record. I have in my story in writing about this some people speaking on the record conceding that there are problems there that are being investigated. Not until now have they become public. It's an unusual event because the charges against the agency and Tom Cooper, who's the executive director, are so sweeping that you don't normally see something like this in a state agency. And it's especially tragic because this is an institute, obviously, formed to honor a great man, to be concerned with nonviolence and brotherhood, and to have charges of sexual harassment and indeed anti-Semitism being made involving an institute like this, a state agency like this, is especially embarrassing.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post, speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Mike Fondacaro. The executive director of the institute, Tom Cooper, refused to go on tape or even discuss the story with our program, but in an earlier interview, Cooper said since the article is not part of any solution, it's part of the problem. He added that he's not trying to tell the Post what it should or should not report, but that the information received by the Post was confidential. New York State's Chief Judge Saul Wachler says drugs are not only destroying society, they are putting a severe strain on the state's legal system. Wachler released his annual State of the Judiciary message this week. Arlie Farbman has this report.
It didn't take long for Wachler to sum up the condition of the state judiciary in 1990. In fact, all he needed was two words: very busy.
We're almost inundated with cases. In the 5 years since I've become the chief judge, we've seen an increase in our felonies go up to 75% over what they were in 1985. In the family court, we've had an enormous burden. We've seen an increase of some 400% in just the last 5 years in abuse and neglect cases, because unfortunately the five-year period during which I have been chief judge have been known as the crack years, and we've seen this enormous impact on our courts.
The term the crack years refers, of course, to the cocaine derivative. Wachler says that drug's effect on New York State's courts has been not only tremendous, but devastating.
Crack is like no other drug when it comes to the ability on the part of people to ingest it or use it. It's very inexpensive. It gives you a euphoric high, and it's extremely addictive. And probably the most troublesome aspect of it is that, unlike heroin and cocaine, which was more difficult as far as use was concerned, by women particularly, crack is very easily used because it's in smokable form. So that we have many more women using crack than in our history with respect to other other drugs. The effect of this, of course, is on the children, the crack babies.
In the past year alone, some 25,000 crack babies were born. And now almost 500,000 children have parents addicted to crack. Wachler says these children are at great risk for domestic violence. Along with all of those problems comes an increase in drug-related crime.
Again, to take that five-year span, as far as our prison population is concerned, we've seen it grow from 32,000 to 55,000. And as you know, the state just can't build the prisons fast enough. And we've seen the same impact, of course, on the courts. For every one person who goes to prison, we're putting through some five different trials. So that, again, the burden on the trial courts is enormous for the reason that you just state, the crime. The crime where people are either on drugs when they commit the crime, they're committing the crime to get money to buy drugs, or they're directly drug-related. So that we find that some 80% of the crime we now have in New York State is related somehow or other to drugs.
Another concern of Wachler's is New York City's crime problem. Earlier this fall, the tabloids would report the trouble almost daily with huge headlines. Wachler says tabloids can create a sense of hysteria, but the situation still needs work.
I don't think it really is that bad. I mean, it's not as some would lead you to believe that you can't walk down the streets in safety. But there is a great prevalence of crime in certain areas, the so-called high crime areas. And presented a citizenry which is a caricature of a people which prides itself on civil liberties. We find people in the city living behind triple locked doors, afraid to go out at night. So it's bad. It's very bad. We have to do more to accomplish what Mayor Dinkins refers to as a safe city with safe streets.
And the state's other cities, Buffalo, Albany, Syracuse, Rochester, are all catching up with New York City.
We're finding that in many of those cities, we're having the same problems that have already become predominant in New York City. We're seeing increases in every one of them, in the amount of felony arrests, in the amount of felony trials, in the amount of incarcerations, and in the amount of crime. This crack has been referred to as an epidemic. And it is indeed an epidemic, and it's spreading.
On Wachler's wish list for next year, more judges, courts, education, and rehabilitation programs. He'd also like to see the media start focusing on innovative solutions to crime problems, as well as the problems themselves. Wachler also requested a 15% judicial pay raise. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lee Farbman.
New York State's Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen took some time out this week to discuss current issues with our Mike Fondacaro.
Sir, the labor negotiations, by all accounts, are not going well. What is your impression of them?
I think that we're at an impasse with the labor unions with respect to reductions in the cost of our workforce for the current fiscal year. Not surprisingly, all of the public employee unions have rejected our idea of a mandatory furlough where everybody takes 5 days off and loses 5 days' pay. We think that's a fairer way to save money in the crisis the state finds itself in today than to lay off massive numbers of people so that we could achieve the same savings. And we think the issue is now squarely before the legislature. We tried to bargain with our employee unions to amend our existing contracts. The unions have rejected that proposal, and now it's up to the legislature to decide whether our proposal merits their imposing it or whether they have some other idea to save $135 million.
How much influence do you think the legislature can have on CSEA, especially to get them back to the table?
I really don't think we're going to be able to bargain this. I think CSEA tried in good faith to merge this with some other issues that are longer term that they're interested in. We were willing to sit down, and we did. Liz Moore, our chief negotiator, virtually all weekend. They did not come up with a grand solution. I think that's to be understood and perhaps even expected. We're going to respect our public employee unions, and we're going to negotiate with them for new contracts. But in the amendment of the existing contract, I think we have to turn to the legislature and say we tried, but we are at an impasse. We need you to resolve this impasse.
Do you think they will have any success whatsoever? We've seen CSEA, PEP, and Council 82 steadfastly so, really holding to their positions. Can the legislature do anything at this point?
Well, the legislature can pass a law changing the existing contract based on the emergency of the moment, and they can only do so after we discuss these issues with the unions, and we have not been able to resolve them. I think it's clear that we have discussed them. We cannot resolve them with the unions. And certainly the legislature has the power with their action and upon approval of the governor to impose this kind of a solution.
And finally, sir, last week you told our audience that you and Governor Cuomo would be sitting on the sidelines while the battle went on for the for the minority leadership in the state Senate. Are you at all, most people are not at all surprised with Manfred Orenstein's return to the minority leadership post. Are you not surprised?
I don't think anyone is surprised when the existing leader of a legislature is reelected, even when they're challenged. It's always a surprise when somebody is turned out. While we're not surprised, the governor and I have expressed our congratulations and good wishes to Fred Ornstein.
Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen speaking with the Legislative Gazette's Mike Fondacaro. Joining us next with a look at some other events taking place in state government this week is Paul Rosenthal with our Legislative Notebook.
A coalition of local government, school, and business officials urged the New York State Legislature to repeal a law they say adds 20% to 30% to the cost of construction. Daniel Walsh, a former state lawmaker who now heads the powerful business council, called the Wicks Law the granddaddy of mandates. The law requires government entities to separate construction projects into at least three different contracts. Officials say this creates coordination problems, which in turn lead to costly project delays and lawsuits over whose fault the delays are. Coalition spokesman said since the governor and legislature plan to cut their state aid, the least they could do is repeal the Wicks Law so they can save some money when building or expanding schools, fire stations, and town halls. Mental health advocates sang the blues this week, hoping to persuade Governor Cuomo and the legislature to avoid cuts to mental health programs. The advocates gathered at the Capitol, singing to protest an estimated $53 million in cuts to mental health programs. About 1,500 people were bused in from across the state for the protest, which wound up with a rally on the Capitol steps. The protesters want the governor to keep his promise of quality care for the mentally ill, a promise they say is broken with each budget cut. Governor Cuomo has introduced a package of reforms he and statewide county leaders hope can reduce property taxes by easing the burden of costly state mandates on localities. Based largely on the recommendations of a panel of county executives from around the state, the plan would revise Medicaid and public assistance expenditures by allowing flexibility in delivering services and revise eligibility and payment requirements for those receiving home relief. For example, shelter allowances could be paid directly to a landlord, and utility payments by those on public assistance would be discounted 15% if their bills were paid directly from the government to the utility. The bill would also allow local governments to contract with banks to collect local taxes and impose a variety of service fees to raise money. Another part of the plan would give local governments more latitude in their borrowing practices. A former Manhattan state senator has written Governor Cuomo a letter urging him to spend money to make money by hiring more bean counters to ferret out tax cheats. Jerome Wilson, now in private law practice and spokesman for the Fair Tax Action Committee, says a single tax auditor can bring in 20 to 30 times his salary in unpaid sales taxes every year. He suggests that the state government ask business and industry to inform on their non-taxpaying competitors who may not be paying their fair share and thus have an unfair advantage. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Paul Rosenthal.
And that about does it for this week's show. Join us again next week at this time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Gallatly.
The program is made possible with grants from the Legislative Gazette, the newspaper about state government. Subscription information available by calling 518-473-6482. And Empire Information Services, serving New York and New England with electronic news release distribution.
State worker furloughs, budget cuts, and the legislature return to Albany for a special session. I'm Dave Gallatly. Coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette, we'll update you on a busy week in state government. Join us each week for the Legislative Gazette.